Tonight on Arena, Jez Cav on her new show, Fermented Dreams, and we talk to the director of the new prison film, Sing Sing. Well, it's early to be talking about the Oscars, but one film that's got tongues wagging since its stateside release is Sing Sing, a prison drama of sorts, drawing favourable comparisons with classics like The Shawshank Redemption. But really, this is a very different kind of film. The project came about after writer and director Greg Quidar got involved in the Rehabilitation Through the Arts theatre programme in the real Sing Sing prison in upstate New York. After meeting men who benefited from being involved, he had the idea for a feature film based around the work of the theatre programme. And it's the casting that's really fascinating here. Oscar-nominated actor Coleman Domingo takes the lead role of John Devine G. Whitfield, a wrongly convicted man who finds solace in the arts. But alongside Coleman, in most of the key supporting roles are men who took part in the theatre programme when they themselves were incarcerated. And this includes Clarence Macklin, whom Variety tipped last week for a Best Supporting Actor nomination next spring at the Oscars. Recently, I spoke to the writer-director Greg Quidar about his film Sing Sing. But before we hear my conversation with Greg, let's get a sense of the film.
To die. To sleep. To dream.
This is a clemency hearing for your conviction, 25 to life. Since you've been in custody, you've been involved in a theater program.
It's been a program that was established to help people get more in touch with their feelings and truly get some rehabilitation.
I am Gladiator Goliath!
I'm Prince Hamlet of Denmark.
And it's turned into something, wonderful.
What part do you play?
From time to time, I do act, like we all do.
So are you acting at all during this interview?
Greg, tell us about what you saw when you were making a short documentary inside a maximum security prison in Kansas that really inspired Sing Sing.
Well, thank you. This was actually 8 years ago. I was producing that short documentary, and we were doing a doc about something else, but on a tour of the facility, I passed by a cell, and there was a young man raising a rescue dog inside of a cell, which stopped me in my tracks, because in that moment, all my expectations about prison and incarcerated people were upended. And a lot of those expectations were from the movies I grew up watching. And yet here in this cell was something that was completely going against the current of those expectations, which was healing that was happening in both directions between this man and this animal. And that's what started it all. I mean, that night in the hotel room on Google, I discovered the program that this movie is based on, Rehabilitation Through the Arts, just by asking Google who is doing things differently in prison, and they were at the top of the search field.
So Rehabilitation Through the Arts is what opened the door to the dramatic workshops that are at the centre of Sing Sing. So how did you go about finding them, and then how did it develop on into a wish to make a film about this?
Well, it all really happened that night in the hotel room. You know, I learned very quickly that they were this program in New York, that it was established in 1996 at Sing Sing, and they had been putting on plays ever since. And they had been covered in all the major press. They had done all the classic plays. But there was an Esquire article from 2005 about the production inside Sing Sing of a time-traveling musical comedy called Breaking the Mummy's Code. And there was just something about the tone of that piece, the playfulness of the work juxtaposed against such a dark environment. You know, I felt the joy of the process, and I was just desperate to have some of that feeling in my own life. And so I reached out to the journalist, I reached out to RTA, and I reached out to the real theater teacher, Brent Buell, who had been a 10-year volunteer and had wrote that play. And I got on the phone very quickly with him, and you know, after a conversation, he was like, well, if you really want to know the power of what this program is, you need to meet the men that really lived it. Come to New York, come to my apartment, we'll have breakfast, and I'll invite some of my friends over. And so my creative partner, Clint, and I, we flew up there, and around that table, they kind of recreated that magical safe space that the program was on the inside. And several of the men that are in this film and that the movie is centered on were at that first breakfast. You know, the real Clarence Devine I. Macklin, who stars in the film as a version of himself, acting opposite the real Divine G, who Coleman Domingo portrays in the movie. They were both there all those years ago.
Goodness. So from the very beginning, you must have said, or said to yourself, that if I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it with ex-prisoners, people who've gone through the program.
Well, I think at the very, you know, really, even from that moment, we felt the immense talent that the program had produced through the work. I mean, not just acting talent. Yes, there was extraordinary talent. They had amazing training from teachers like Brent and many other volunteers. They had put on a lot of shows in their time through the program. But there was another kind of talent, and it's this, you know, it's this raw vulnerability that they had the courage to express in their daily lives and through the work of the program that was kind of miraculous to be in the presence of. And so we knew that we wanted the alumni to be in the movie and featured in it, but with time we just grew more confident and realized, like, oh, this is the life force of the movie and these men need to be at the very center of it.
Now, the character that plays John Devine G. Whitfield is played by Coleman Domingo. So you chose Coleman to play this character, who's kind of the linchpin of the film. Mm-hmm. And obviously you needed an inspirational and wonderful actor like Coleman to play that.
Yeah, you know, I think for an audience to have someone that they could trust so implicitly as a performer like Coleman to carry us through this very unfamiliar world and to introduce us to this wonderful group of people, he, you know, he has this ability to be so commanding in a performance, but also convey entire stories just across a look in his face. You know, he's an actor that you would never want to call cut because something was always being explored and happening in his performance. And he was also very generous too. You know, he's the type of person that would come into a room and not only be able to command a scene, but also be very generous and really help other people shine around him.
Yes, and his character then is somebody who is innocent and he's trying to fight the conviction that he's in prison for.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, he plays the character based on the real Divine G, who was wrongfully incarcerated and spent 25 years in prison trying to prove his innocence, you know, and it took an amazing fortitude and you know, a big question that Coleman was asking through the performance and in our preparation was just, how do you hold on to that light and, you know, and survive that long? And, you know, I think the lifeline was really this community and these friendships and the program around him.
Now, the other central character is Clarence Devine I. Macklin, and he plays himself in the film. Mm-hmm. And he is just this bundle of repression and energy. He's just so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Clarence is a revelation. You know, when I met him 8 years ago, I almost felt him before he walked through the door. He just has... He just has that presence, that it, that aura, that, you know, magic that someone who becomes a star just has inherently. We don't know how to describe it. We just know it when we see it. And so I was like, well, that guy has to be in the movie. And as we progressed and once we decided to center the movie on this friendship between the real Divine G and Divine I remember calling him and just being like, well, what do you think? Do you want to play Divine Eye as Divine Eye in this film? He's like, well, was there anyone else who was going to do it? and he was like, you know, I'm a ham. If you put a spotlight on the floor, I'm going to jump right in the middle of it. And, you know, he just took the moment for everything it was worth. And, you know, really, it's very a hard thing to do to, you know, play different versions of yourself throughout your life, you know, and to chart that evolution as an actor that's both representative of yourself, that's synthesizing things that he had observed, you know, in his time inside, and a little bit aspirational too, you know, as well as who he really did evolve into. And so that was a lot to carry in one performance, and he did it brilliantly.
Yes, because he has wonderful character arc in the film. He starts and he's dealing drugs on the yard, and he's you know, he's a heavy, really. And then when he starts in the workshop, he's very sensitive and touchy, and you feel, you know, quite flammable.
Yes, and that really kind of is the beauty of how this process can unfold, and really did with him. And, you know, he was someone who got respect through fear and really used that as a survival mechanism when he was inside early in his incarceration. And as he started to discover the artist that was always within him that had gotten kind of buried, you know, he really grappled with, you know, can he truly live the thing that he thinks is most special and beautiful inside him, or is he destined to continue the fate that he had lived before this? And that wrestling was beautiful to watch him contend with throughout his performance.
Yes, because almost bully-like, he jumps on the role of Hamlet in this Breaking the Mummy Code. And then when the leader of the workshop and Coleman's character begin to challenge him about, you know, that he really isn't very regal in how he's playing Hamlet, it really challenges him. And it's that thing of being, I suppose, in all great workshops where you have to break yourself down.
Yeah, and you know, he's actually reprising a role that he really did in 2005 in the original production of Breaking the Mummy's Code. He played Hamlet then, and he's playing Hamlet now. And you know, I think within that, you know, there's questions within that famous soliloquy that I think feel very representative of the personal journey that he was also on.
Now, you made this over quite a short period of time, and you couldn't film in Sing Sing, but there are outside shots of Sing Sing, and you did film it in a decommissioned prison. Is that right?
Yeah. So all the exteriors in the movie is the real place. You know, it's an iconic prison. It's over 200 years old, or almost 200 years old. And you know, it's something that can't be replicated, that we needed to showcase in some way. And then for all the interiors of the facility, this was also a maximum security prison called Downstate that had been decommissioned 1 month before we went in there as a set. And what was also unique about this is that the entirety of our alumni cast had been incarcerated at Downstate at one point in their journey. It was the place where you were, you know, where most started. If you were going to do a long bid in New York, you would start in Downstate and then migrate to other facilities. And so that was something we were very sensitive about for our alumni cast to go back inside, to put these greens back on again, that, you know, many in our cast had never worn green in any part of their clothing ever again since they had come home. And so that was also a big ask as well.
And what was it like? What was it like for them, Greg?
At one point, there was a lot of apprehension, sure. And I think that struck different people in unique ways. For Clarence Divine Eye Macklin, you know, the cell that he occupies in the film that was redesigned to his exact memories and specifications by our production designer, Ruta Kishkite, was directly beneath a cell he occupied when he was incarcerated there. So that has got to be, you know, I can't even fathom what that might be like emotionally for him. But what he would say is that whatever discomfort he had, the purpose that he was doing and the story he wanted to tell was greater than that. And then once he started to embrace that, then he started to be able to view these greens as not just something that he used to have to wear as a mandated uniform, but now it was a costume by which to express a character. And there was a kind of catharsis within that.
And there's another scene in that Hamlet scenario where he is giving a speech, Clarence Macklin, and there's a character stands behind him. I mean, it's part of the scene, mm-hmm. but he's terribly uncomfortable with that. Was that all written by you, or was that in some way informed by their experiences? Some of it, in other words, it seems so real to the viewer.
That came through conversations with Clarence and the rest of the cast, where we were wanting to chart that he, you know, was evolving through the work, and that he was becoming more confident in performing this soliloquy, and how to chart that growth. And, you know, there were more obvious ways that you could render that of like, oh, he just can't remember his lines or this or that, and he's was overly confident, and now he's feeling the pressure of really doing the work. But in conversations with Clarence, he was like, you know, he brought up the fact that if someone were to walk behind him, you know, out in the yard, that would be a threat. And so now here on a stage, he would react. And so that became a much more deeper and unexpected way to show where he was in his progression.
Now, as you say, Coleman Domingo is such a wonderful actor and also a fine human being. But was it difficult for the other people to like act against a star or act with a star? Did that change the dynamic?
It could have been, you know, because Coleman is at the height of his powers, and he could have come in here onto our set and used that as a kind of leverage over everyone else and to draw all the attention to himself. But he stepped in with a posture of realizing he had a lot to offer, both just within his own performance, but also as a teacher to a lot of our cast who had never been in a film before. They'd been on stage, but not in front of a camera. And then he also, within that, had the humility to recognize that he had a lot to learn from these men who had really lived this. And so within that, there's this mutual respect, and an alchemy started to form of an exchange rather than anything transactional. And I think that helped them collectively transcend to a higher plane.
Now, there's a lot of Oscar buzz about the film. What's it like to having the film talked about so far ahead of the awards season?
There's a mantra within the program that's just trust the process, you know, and I think within that it's not to really do too much that's focused on results, but really at the work at hand. And I think for us, and something I take personally, is within that, I think it's about just being present in the moment, you know, and I think that's one of the skills that's almost hardest to learn as an actor and a creative is to really be in front of and within the moment that you're existing in. And so that's really where our mindset is to continue to tell the story of the movie and ensure that people have a chance to experience it, you know, and hopefully fall in love with it in the same way that we do.
Thank you, Greg. That was Greg Cuidar, director of Sing Sing. And Sing Sing is in cinemas from Friday. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Dublin-based musician Jez Cav is a frequent visitor on Arena. Tonight she joins us with her very own new musical play, Fermented Dreams, which will show at Bewley's Café Theatre from September the 9th to the 14th. The play is part of this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. The play is an amalgam of Cav's solo musical work, her experience in the music industry, and her emerging talent in theatre. Fermented Dreams includes seven unreleased songs around which Jess has written a semi-autobiographical script. It is described as a coming-of-age story for adults who didn't get the memo in their teens. Welcome, Jess. You're very welcome back to Arena.
Thank you so much.
So now you have a lot of strings to your bow. You've been in here performing for us, and you've also done a lot of collaborations, everyone from Hozier to Villagers, Codaline. What was it that made you decide to write a scripted piece rather than songs?
Absolutely. Well, I did a lovely stretch in the Abbey there last year up until November 2023. And then after that, I was very lucky that I had the opportunity to go to a retreat for about a week just by the burn. And I went with my kind of co-writer, collaborator, Jeff Warner Clayton. And we spent a week writing music. And when we kind of finished and I listened back to the demos, I was just really, really touched by kind of the level of musicianship that was in the songs. I was really excited about them. And I just didn't want to do the thing that I had done before, you know, which is, you know, put them out and put them on Spotify and do the things that, you know, we usually do.
Why didn't you want to do that?
I think the level of success can vary so much, you know, and it felt like I was doing the songs a disservice, just throwing them out onto a streaming service. So I wanted to do something that was a little bit more meatier and made the songs a bit more tangible, I guess. And so I decided to write a play around it called Fermented Dreams, Dreams Not Dead, Just Smelling Funny. And it was the idea of what was coming up in a lot of the songs for me as I, you know, as I reach 40, is that it was a renegotiation of hope, a renegotiation of my dreams. Where are my childhood dreams? How do I renegotiate with them as an adult? Are they still there? And that's really what the play is about. You know, it's about how I've kind of grappled with my dreams, with my hopes from being a child up until now.
Now, work of Billie Holiday's also inspired the shape of what you were going to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was very lucky to see Billie Holiday at Emerson's Bar and Grill a couple of years ago in London in the West End. And I was just blown away by it. It was incredible. And the kind of the idea of it was that it's a kind of a gig within a gig. You know, it's a particular gig that happened to Billie at kind of the end of her life. She's still using. She's not in a great space, you know. And you're kind of watching this person kind of sing a song and tell a story, and you're starting to see this tension between her and the band, and also the tension between her and the audience. And I remember watching it going, I've never really seen other pieces and other plays that are able to represent that, the tension between a singer and a musician on the stage. You know, she's trying to get off the stage when she gets upset after telling a story. She's going off, she's trying to drink or do whatever, and the musicians are trying to get her back, you know, while performing, while watching the audience. And I just loved that. I loved how it was portrayed. So I'm trying to kind of do a bit of that in my show as well with the musician.
And so on stage then, there's you and there's the musician.
That's
and
right.
There are other, are they people or there's three other people on stage, or are they just seats with signs on them?
They are just seats. She is, so Noelle is, she's coming.
Noelle
in.
Is the central character.
Absolutely.
The you character.
Yes, indeed. And Noelle, she's having a bit of a day and she has this showcasing event. And she's shown up late. So she already shows up really, really freaked out and really, you know, panicked and so on. And she's performing to these three redeemers, and these three redeemers essentially are representing the people, you know, that she's trying to seek validation from. And, you know, she ignores everybody else in the room. And really what I'm trying to show people is that that's such a human thing. You know, we seek this validation and we tend to ignore all the people around us that are actually there giving us support, you know.
All right. Well, let's listen to one of the tracks from it. You'll perform from the show shortly, but this is one of the tracks, and this is Cycle.
Yes.
So beautiful in the palm of my hand, so difficult to keep it safe. So beautiful out of my hands, difficult to keep it safe. See the grain. And it's been a grind, ground down to sand. Turn the hourglass again and again. And again. Some is yours and some is mine. Now who's to blame? We all have shame, but it's so hard to look you in the eye. And it's all colors, no outline. All colors, am I high or am I crying?
Jess Cav in beautiful and full voice there in her singing cycle. And that's a song from Fermented Dreams. And Jess is both the writer and performer in Fermented Dreams. Jess, tell us about that song cycle. It was about breaking the cycle, obviously, cycle of, I don't know.
Breaking the cycle, indeed. Yeah, I mean, I think within my circles, there's kind of this term that people use about breaking the cycle and being a bit of a scapegoat. If you've come from a family where you've really broken a lot of the traditions that have come before you within your family, you're considered to be quite a cycle breaker, you know. And I found that I really liked that idea, and I really liked that idea that maybe that's who I was, you know.
You mean
I was
repeating behaviours that other members of your family would have done?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Negative ones in particular, you know. And that being on your kind of journey of healing, you know, that you're kind of breaking those negative behaviours, those cycles of negative behaviours. And what I found is that when I continued on this journey, I liked this idea, but I really wasn't putting the work in. And I realized that there was plenty of things that I was doing that were particularly negative behaviors that I needed to look at. So the idea is, yeah, I thought that I'd break the cycle, but here I am in uniform, I'm marching, reacting, no reform. And it's, yeah, it's just a lot of self-perception, I guess.
Yes, because the story does go into some of those excesses, I suppose. You know, if you want to call them excesses, there's some drinking, there's some drug taking, there's lots of sex.
Yeah.
Not saying any of these, well, some maybe the drugs and too much drink are bad things. I don't know about the sex.
Yeah.
These were all things, the stories you wanted to tell.
Yeah, definitely. You know, what's important for me within the show as well is, like, you know, when you're a performer and you're an entertainer, and especially when I was growing up, you know, I was learning like jazz and soul, and I was doing this in like 2005 and 2006. And people were like, what are you doing? Like, why aren't you playing, you know, country music? Why aren't you playing blah, blah, blah? You know, the music that was considered popular at the time in Ireland. And, you know, we used to laugh about it and go like, oh, people just don't get it. But it took its toll on us. And we went out and we sought connection and we sought validation. And, you know, it's very forgivable and it's very human that we try to seek that validation and that connection through, you know, particular excesses, you know. And I think it's important for me, you know, now to kind of look back at that time and to consider, you know, the motivations, I guess, behind it. And it's all a part of my process. You know, it's all a part of the creative process for me.
Yes, because we were both listening to your voice there and I was saying how wonderful it sounds. And yeah. you said, well, you've been doing a lot of work on your physical well-being to yes. make your voice sound better.
Absolutely. Yeah, I haven't quit drinking about 6-7 months ago. And actually, when I wrote the play, I was 2 weeks sober. So it's quite interesting even to kind of start the play kind of 2 weeks sober in and then to kind of finish the play 7 months sober. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
Now, you also go back into your family. And in many mm-hmm. ways, this is a celebration of your mother.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, you say, you know, you describe her with her dark skin and the voice like Anne Doyle.
Well, that's what I use the term when I talk about the maternal legacy, you know, and Noelle is a character. She's trying to touch into, you know, she calls the big we, you know, nothing better than the big we. And that's the kind of the universal mother, the universal kind of maternal legacy that we're all connected to, you know. And this is a thing she's kind of going between, you know, I really want to be popular and I really want these people in the industry to like me and I really want to be the cool person. But at the same time, she's also like learning so much about herself and she's on this spiritual path and it's just not aligning, you know. And so she's kind of going in between the two worlds within the play constantly, you know. And I think that's going to be shown really beautifully with the lights and with the music and so on. But yes, but then there is also a celebration of my mother and when I was born and my my godmother, Olive, who's an amazing traveller woman, and how both of them brought me into the world at the site of my continuation, I think is what I say in the play. And yeah, so there's definitely, you know, when I lost my mom about 17 years ago, I lost her just before I turned 21. So, you know, grief and death are also things that very much inform my creative process and are part of the play, you know.
Yes, and absence as well, because you talk about the absence of your father.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, he was very much never there, you know, and it's all very coloured with this sense of humour, you know, throughout the play, because, you know, as a musician and as a front person, let's just say, you know, people are always like, you know, get out there, be a little bit vulnerable. People love that. And I'm like, you want me to be vulnerable about my trauma? OK, but it is a lot, you know. And so it's kind of it's playing with that idea of being vulnerable, being like, OK, this is it. This is cards on the table. This is where I come from. This is my complex and colour background, you know. But it's all done in a lot of fun and a bit of humour, too.
Yes, because you talk about your father not being there or available to you.
Yeah.
And then he had another family and you got to meet.
But I did get to meet them. Yeah. And so that's a part of the play I talk about, you know, it was like the day that I found out my dad died. And this is in the play. I kind of say, like, you know, my mom said, I don't know how to tell you this, but your dad's dead. You've got two brothers and two sisters on your dad's side. We never told you about. And you're meeting one of them tomorrow. And that was my introduction into my teens. That was just before I turned 13. You know, that was said to me. So that was such a big thing to say to a 13-year-old girl. And, you know, and I remember when it happened, you know, I was asking them loads of questions and they were like, well, tell you when you're older. And I'm like, listen, I'm here. I'm dealing with it. Just tell me the info. But yeah, so it was a really interesting time. And once again, it coloured how I perceived the world and it coloured how I seeked validation and connection in the world. And I think when I started to be creative and when I started to perform and to create, it was very difficult to separate the two.
And that was very soon after that, wasn't it, that you started performing?
Yeah, I was 13 exactly when I started performing in a drama school. And my first song was Donna Summer, Bad Girls. So that was probably not the most, you know, appropriate thing to give a 13-year-old girl. But, you know, it was like the late 90s, early 2000s. So anything goes. But no, I loved it. And I loved Donna Summer and I love soul music. So it was great. But yeah, it's, you know, when you've had such a difficult childhood or a challenging childhood, I would say, you know, it's always going to follow into your creativity and how you're perceived.
Now, we have another song, but you are going to perform some of the prose of the piece for us.
Yes.
Do you need to you need to talk us into it a little bit, do you, Jess?
Yes, I will. Yeah. So, you know, throughout this, you know, Noelle is on a bit of a path. You know, she's starting off with attempting to sell herself. And as she continues through, she's searching for her autonomy and she's searching for kind of the reason why she's there at all. you know, doing this, and if she still needs to be doing this, and if she still wants to be doing this. So this is kind of mid act two.
Would you like to swing on a star?
I read somewhere that chronic daydreaming is just a form of escapism from a dysfunctional reality. I would dream all the time to be saved. Saved by someone. Led by someone. An adoring crowd. A manager fighting my corner. Maybe all of this was just chronic daydreaming and I had the misfortune to actually be able to sing. And I've bandied from venue to venue, roaring proud Mary here, roaring proud Mary there, with all of it just out of reach. And maybe if I quit drinking, if I lost some weight, when I get my teeth fixed, maybe somehow I'll shoulder my way in front of the cat videos and dog adoption posts and sponsored ads for pelvic floor strengtheners and you'll see me. You'll really see what I have to offer. And I'll realise it never really mattered. And then what? And then where? And how? Maybe a cushy DJ job? Maybe my back catalogue will gain a cult following? Move to Dubai? Relocate? Or maybe I'll never make it and I was never meant to. I was just an exploited, chronic daydreamer. Just a vessel.
That's Jez Cav there performing from Fermented Dreams, her show that's going on at the Beaulieu Cafe Theatre from September the 9th to the 14th. And that's part of Dublin Fringe Festival. Your character is very hard on herself.
She is. She is incredibly, you know, when I was writing her, I kind of felt like, oh, she's definitely a little bit weaker than me and she's having a tougher time than I am. And she's made these, you know, and then the more I wrote her, I was like, I actually think she's braver than me. You know, and I think the way that she's able to be this vulnerable in front of people of influence is something that I would possibly still struggle with, which is possibly why I'm doing this. there you go.
Well, obviously, we have great sympathy and empathy with you, with Noelle's character.
Yeah.
But the character I feel very sorry for is the poor musician.
Yes.
He's there and he wants to get you back on track, but you're going off on these little reveries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, and this is exactly it. You know, I'm trying to show, you know, because I think people on a day to day basis, they don't really get to see that tension and that dynamic between a singer and a musician and how complex it can be. And yeah, poor. Well, it's going to be Lewis Young who's going to be performing with me, who's an amazing, amazing musician. He's actually MDing Abbey Coulibaly for the Coldplay gigs this week. So he's amazing. And so he's going to be looking after Noel. Oh, in Beaulieu's.
Well, he'll have his hands full with that.
Oh, he will, yeah.
So we'll just play a little of the Diary song. Do you want to tell us something about this?
Yeah, so this is a beautiful song written with Jeff Warner Clayton, a part of that retreat that I spoke about earlier on. And it's definitely an exercise on vulnerability again and feeling exposed. It's all words that I took directly from my diary, and it's called Diary Song.
Ooh. trees. I just forget how pretty when I'm living in the city. And I drink too much wine, always a little hungover.
That's Diary Song from Fermented Dreams, the new show from Jess Cav, which will be on at Bewley's Cafe Theatre from September the 9th to the 14th. For further information, go to fringefestival.ie. And Jess, you're also performing on Saturday, September the 21st, when you'd be performing with the National Concert Orchestra in the Three Arena, less, in a celebration of Leonard Cohen's songs. Do you know what song you're playing yet?
No, I haven't been told yet.
All right.
Well, but I'm excited.
Jess, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Based in Tokyo, Banana Yoshimoto is known as the poet of solitude. She is the internationally best-selling, prize-winning author of over 20 books, including her debut novel, Kitchen, from 1988. Dead End Memories has just been published. It is her 11th book to come out in English. It's a collection of five stories of healing and hope. In each one, a woman who has gone through trauma finds solace, sometimes in everyday life. Mary McGill has been reading Dead End Memories for us, and she joins me now on the line. So Mary, as I said, her novel Kitchen sold millions of copies worldwide and has been made into two feature films, I think. Will you tell us who Banana Yoshimoto is and what makes her so popular?
Yes, well, Banana is actually a pen name. It's Mahoko Yoshimoto, and her dad was a famous critic and poet in Japan, while her sister is a well-regarded Japanese cartoonist. So her background is very, very creative. And you mentioned Kitchen there, which she wrote while she was working as a waitress back in 1988. And that was the Kitchen, along with another of her novels, Moonlight Shadow, came out in English in 1993 and became very, very successful. And so we have Dead End Memories today, which is, as you said, her 11th novel, or her 11th publication in English. It's a set of short stories. And she has... She can be kind of divisive critically, because there are people, and she's hugely popular in Japan and she's hugely popular around the world, but there are critics who see her style as quite childlike and quite simplistic. To that, I would say that her stories are very, very accessible. But that simplicity should not be mistaken for something that's lacking, because there is, as we'll discuss, great depth to her stories and her storytelling.
Now, she's not even, whatever people might think about how simplistically or not she writes, she's not afraid of dark and dark subjects, is she?
No, not at all. And there's quite a lot of that in these stories. So each of the characters, each of the female characters has suffered something in their backgrounds. And what often starts or kickstarts the story is that they're undergoing some sort of suffering again. And these two elements collide and kind of bring the characters to the point where, as a reader, you could see how they would give in to the suffering. So if they have suffered, we'll say, as some of the characters have, sexual trauma, if they've been abandoned by their parents, as some of them have, if they are suffering any number of regular heartbreaks, so less dramatic, but we'll say been abandoned by a fiancé and so on and so forth, you could see how they could choose to let those circumstances overwhelm them. But what Banana Yoshimoto does is that she has characters who choose something other than victimhood. That's not to say they don't wallow or they don't get upset or they don't get frustrated and so on, but they find something within themselves, often through their connections with other people and the world, that manages to offer them a way out and up and through the difficulties in their lives.
Now, you were saying one of the stories is about a young woman abandoned by her fiancé. That's the title story, isn't it, about heartbroken Mimi?
Yes, poor Mimi. So Mimi is, on the one hand, you have to feel for her, because she has had this kind of childhood romance, which she thinks is going to translate into a grand grown-up romance and they're going to live happily ever after. But she's been tolerating a lot of very, very bad behaviour from her fiancé, so much so that her younger sister is encouraging her to kind of grow a spine. And when she eventually confronts him, the fact that he has really dramatically moved on and is not thinking of her at all becomes very clear. And so Mimi kind of falls apart. And in falling apart, she moves into a little flat over her uncle's restaurant. And I will say, I mean, you mentioned kitchen earlier on. There are lovely references to food and restaurants and the common, the kind of the family and the pleasure that orientates around, you know, kind of family run restaurants in Japan, and also the pleasure of food and eating and the kind of interhuman connection that, that it fosters. So Mimi is living here and her uncle assigns Nishiyama, who's this kind of free-spirited ladies man, effectively, who works in his restaurant, to kind of keep an eye on her. And they begin to develop this kind of strange but beautiful friendship. And Mimi has to grow up a little bit because she begins to harbour these feelings for Nishiyama that she knows, knowing him, that would, you know, will never come to fruition. But in doing that, she also lets him into her world and has him kind of restore her faith in herself. He teaches her how to stand up for herself. He teaches her how to regain her independence. And so while these two characters, you know, she wants romance, she's not going to get it. But in learning from her relationship with Nishiyama, she can see how, although they were together in time very, very briefly, he has had this profound impact on her life. And these stories are full of those moments where people, through their connections, offer transformative change to characters who are at a really low ebb.
Yes, that's really interesting that she goes back into the past lives of characters and finds characters who in duration may not have been around for a long time, but what they did when the narrator begins to probe into it were quite fundamental.
Yes, absolutely. And it is this idea of the Japanese philosophy of a sensitivity to things, that it is the connections in our lives, the world around us, that have this capacity to transform us. Okay, we must let them, right? So these characters have to get to the point where they are willing to make that connection. One of the stories I absolutely loved in this collection is called Mama, and it is about a young woman who works in editing, and she has been through a lot. She's been abandoned by her mother when she's very, very young. She subsequently becomes poisoned at work, absolutely horrific event, and it leaves her desperately ill. And it's not ill in an acute sense. It becomes, you know, kind of a long-standing, lingering illness that really is impacting every aspect of her life. But through that, she kind of has an outburst at the home of a celebrated Japanese author. And she's mortified. She's convinced she's going to get fired. But the author and his wife are so sympathetic towards her. They're so kind and understanding. And in that compassion, a light bulb goes on and she goes, well, these people were so kind and so compassionate to me. I could do that for myself. And from that, she begins to heal not just her body and this terrible thing that's happened to her in the present, but all the echoes of past harms. And it you know, it's such a kind of, again, this notion of simple. It's a simple story, but there's such profundity in it.
Now, there's a story with ghosts in it and about two college friends who are sharing a house, they think, with each other. But in fact, there are other presences there as well.
Yes, this is House of Ghosts, and it is a round-the-house love story, shall we say. And these ghosts are living there as well. They're the ghosts of an elderly couple. And initially, the young female narrator is quite freaked out by them. She doesn't understand what they're doing there. And they just seem to be going about their daily job. But this is, or their daily routine. But this is, it actually reminded me of All of Us Strangers, which was a beautiful film starring Paul Mescal and Andrew Scott, about a young man who goes back to his family home and finds his parents still living there, even though it passed away many, many years before. That was based in a Japanese novel as well called Stranger by Tachi Yamada. And I think that this idea, in the West we have this idea of ghosts as things that jump out and scare you. But in the Japanese tradition, the ghosts have the capacity to teach you and to mirror you and to remind you that life continues in different ways and different realms, if you're open to that idea. And so this young woman in the story begins to realise, as her romantic relationship develops in kind of an unusual way, that actually the ghosts were modelling something for her that she couldn't necessarily see at the time. So it's just, again, this idea of something echoing through people's lives and then coming to fruition when they are in a place to fully understand it and then get to grips with it.
So, and then we have a story called Tomo-chan's Happiness. Who do we meet there?
We meet Tomo-chan, and we're rooting for Tomo-chan, Kay, because she has been through a lot. She's you know, she's the victim of sexual assault as a young woman, and her life is kind of quiet and kind of isolated because, you know, she's had relationships, but her lovers tell her that, you know, she's hard to connect with and she's a bit withdrawn. And, you know, as a reader, you're going, well, you know, obviously. But Tamil Chan has followed or developed really strong feelings for a co-worker who is in a relationship. But as the story develops, he becomes single. She begins to make connections with him, and we are just on the cusp of a perfect meet cute. You're like, this is pure romantic comedy territory. Here we go. When Yashimoto does something really interesting with the narrative, I won't say what. And it again, we're back in this space where you're like, ah, there was the kind of simple, straightforward message that you thought we were going to get here about, you know, love and romance and rescuing everything and saving everyone. When in reality, there's something deeper at play here, and she's challenging you to get to grips with it, and also to kind of see Tamil Chan's path maybe as something less obvious and perhaps more difficult, but no less valuable for that.
And is that the first time she makes that kind of intervention? Obviously, she's writing it, but I mean, as the writer, an intervention in the story.
I think for me, that was the one that really, really jumped out at me because it's quite in your face.
Yeah, okay.
It's like a director. It's like we're like Hitchcock or somebody stepping onto the screen and been like, well, this is the reason I did this. But in fact, this is, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I have to say that's a risky move to take because you are, you know, you're breaking the illusion of the narrative flow. But it works. It works because I think because you have this theme that she has so carefully threaded throughout all of these stories. And again, this interruption in the story speaks directly to that theme.
And then we have Not Warm at All. That's the shortest story in the book, but it packs quite a punch, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Again, we have more tragedy. We have a young woman who whose best friend when she was growing up, a kind of guy she thought would, her first love, the guy she thought in kind of, you know, a teenage way she would grow up and to marry, you know, he is murdered by his mother in a murder-suicide. Obviously, completely devastating. But she has processed that grief now, and she's kind of looking back at how formative this relationship was for her, how happy it made her at the time, and how great, and this is another, I mean, the theme of gratitude is central as well, and how grateful she is to have had these kind of, again, these really simple, intimate moments with him while he was alive, probably some of the happiest moments of his life. And she could never understand when they were growing up, you know, he would want to go and hang out at her house and be around her family, and she would have thought that her family and her house weren't nearly as interesting as his. But in hindsight now, she can understand why. And again, it is this idea, again, this person who's been in your life for a brief time, leaving you with something that remakes and has reshaped that life in for the good across the years.
Well, it sounds like you're recommending Dead End Memories by Banana Yoshimoto, Mary.
Well, do you know, the funny thing is I had watched a film called Perfect Days, who it's about a man in Japan who cleans toilets for a living. And it's one of the most life-affirming pieces of cinema I've seen in a very, very long time. It's set in Tokyo. It was nominated for the best actor or the best international film at the Oscars. And there was something about that I just couldn't get enough of. And then I came to this collection of short stories and I was like, here it is again. So yes, Kay, if you're looking for something absolutely you know, life-affirming, if you liked Perfect Days, I think a lot of people did, I would absolutely recommend this. It's very interesting. It's a distinctive style. There's no doubt about that. But there's so much to enjoy here.
Mary McGill, thank you so much. Dead End Memories by Banana Yoshimoto is published by Faber. And that's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound. And tonight's show was produced by Pauline McNamara. And John Creedon is next.